turning to the city hall, to their jail alibi. But didn't the bank watchman say he shot Jerry? That's the way it was in the papers. He said so, but he'd say anything and believe it. He probably emptied his gun with his eyes shut, and anything that fell was his. Didn't you see Jerry drop? Yes, I did, and he was facing the bank, but it was all too confused for me to see who shot him. There were a lot of men shooting, and... Yeah, they'd see to that. I also advertised the fact, at least it looks like a fact to me, that Reno plugged Lou Yard. This Reno is a tough egg, isn't he? Noonan went watery, but all they got out of Reno was a what of it. It was all nice and gentlemanly. They were evenly divided, Pete and Whisper against Noonan and Reno, but none of them could count on his partner backing him up if he made a play, and by the time the meeting was over, the pairs had been split. Noonan was out of the count, and Reno and Whisper, against each other, had Pete against them. So everybody sat around and behaved and watched everybody else, while I juggled death and destruction. Whisper was the first to leave, and he seems to have had time to collect some rods in front of Noonan's house by the time the chief reached home. The chief was shot down. If Pete the Finn meant what he said, and he has the look of a man who would, he'll be out after Whisper. Reno was as much to blame for Jerry's death as Noonan, so Whisper ought to be gunning for him. Knowing it, Reno will be out to get Whisper first, and that will set Pete on his trail. Besides that, Reno will likely have his hands full standing off those of the late Lou Yard's underlings who don't fancy Reno as boss. All in all, it's one swell dish. Dinah Brand reached across the table and patted my hand. Her eyes were uneasy. She said, "It's not your fault, darling. You said yourself that there was nothing else you could do. Finish your drink and we'll have another." "There was plenty else I could do," I contradicted her. Old Elihu ran out on me at first simply because these birds had too much on him for him to risk a break unless he was sure they could be wiped out. He couldn't see how I could do it, so he played with them. He's not exactly their brand of cutthroat, and besides, he thinks the city is his personal property, and he doesn't like the way they've taken it away from him. I could have gone to him this afternoon and showed him that I had them ruined. He'd have listened to reason. He'd have come over to my side, have given me the support I needed to swing the play legally. I could have done that, but it's easier to have them killed off. Easier and surer, and, now that I'm feeling this way, more satisfying. I don't know how I'm gonna come out with the agency. The old man will boil me in oil if he ever finds out what I've been doing. It's this damn town. Poisonville is right. It's poisoned me. Look, I sat at Wilson's table tonight and played them like you'd play trout, and got just as much fun out of it. I looked at Noonan and knew he hadn't a chance in a thousand of living another day because of what I had done to him, and I laughed and felt warm and happy inside. That's not me. I've got hard skin all over what's left of my soul, and after 20 years of messing around with crime, I can look at any sort of a murder without seeing anything in it but my bread and butter, the day's work. But this getting a rear out of planning deaths is not natural to me. It's what this place has done to me. She smiled too softly and spoke too indulgently. You exaggerate so, honey. They deserve all they get. I wish you wouldn't look like that. You make me feel creepy. I grinned, picked up the glasses, and went out to the kitchen for more gin. When I came back, she frowned at me over anxious dark eyes and asked, Now, what did you bring the ice pick in for? To show you how my mind's running. A couple of days ago, if I thought about it at all, it was as a good tool to pry off chunks of ice. I ran a finger down its half foot of round steel blade to the needle point. Not a bad thing to pin a man to his clothes with. That's the way I'm begging. On the level. I can't even see a mechanical cigar lighter without thinking of filling one with nitroglycerin for somebody you don't like. There's a piece of copper wire lying in the gutter in front of your house. Thin, soft, and just long enough to go around a neck with two ends to hold on. I had one hell of a time to keep from picking it up and stuffing it in my pocket, just in case.
You're crazy.
I know it. That's what I've been telling you. I'm going blood simple.
Well, I don't like it. Put that thing back in the kitchen and sit down and be sensible.
I obeyed two-thirds of the order.
The trouble with you is, she scolded me, your nerves are shot. You've been through too much excitement in the last few days. Keep it up and you're going to have the heebie-jeebies for fair, a nervous breakdown.
I held up a hand with spread fingers. It was steady enough. She looked at it and said,
That doesn't mean anything. It's inside you. Why don't you sneak off for a couple of days' rest? You've got things here so they'll run themselves. Let's go down to Salt Lake. It'll do you good.
Can't, sister. Somebody's got to stay here to count the dead. Besides, the whole program is based on the present combination of people and events. Our going out of town would change that, and the chances are the whole thing would have to be gone over again.
Nobody would have to know you were gone, and I've got nothing to do with it.
Since when? She leaned forward, made her eyes small, and asked,
Now what are you getting at?
Nothing. Just wondering how you got to be a disinterested bystander all of a sudden. Forgotten that Donald Wilson was killed because of you, starting the whole thing? Forgotten that it was the dope you gave me on Whisper that kept the job from petering out in the middle?
You know just as well as I do that none of that was my fault, she said indignantly. And it's all past anyway. You're just bringing it up because you're in a rotten humor and want to argue.
It wasn't past last night when you were scared stiff Whisper was going to kill you.
Will you stop talking about killing?
Young Albury once told me Bill Quint had threatened to kill you, I said.
Stop it!
You seem to have a gift for stirring up murderous notions in your boyfriends. There's Albury waiting trial for killing Wilson. There's Whisper who's got you shivering in corners. Even I haven't escaped your influence. Look at the way I've turned. And I've always had a private notion that Dan Rolfe's gonna have a try at you someday.
Dan! You're crazy! Why, I...
Yeah. He was a lunger and down and out, and you took him in. You gave him a home and all the laudanum he wants. You use him for errand boy. You slap his face in front of me and slap him around in front of others. He's in love with you. One of these mornings you're gonna wake up and find he's whittled your neck away. She shivered, got up and laughed.
I'm glad one of us knows what you're talking about, if you do, she said as she carried our empty glasses through the kitchen door.
I lit a cigarette and wondered why I felt the way I did, wondered if I were getting psychic, wondered whether there was anything in this presentiment business or whether my nerves were just ragged.
The next best thing for you to do, if you won't go away, the girl advised me when she returned with full glasses, is to get plastered and forget everything for a few hours. I put a double slug of gin in yours. You need it.
It's not me, I said, wondering why I was saying it, but somehow enjoying it. It's you. Every time I mention killing, you jump on me. You're a woman. You think if nothing's said about it, maybe none of the God only knows how many people in town who might want to will kill you. That's silly. Nothing we say or don't say is going to make Whisper. For instance,
please, please stop. I am silly. I am afraid of the words. I'm afraid of him. Oh, why didn't you put him out of the way when I asked you?
Sorry, I said, meaning it.
Do you think he...
I don't know, I told her, and I reckon you're right. There's no use talking about it. The thing to do is drink.
though there doesn't seem to be much body to this djinn. That's you, not the djinn. Do you want an honest-to-God rear? I'd drink nitroglycerin tonight. That's just about what you're going to get, she promised me. She rattled bottles in the kitchen and brought me in a glass of what looked like the stuff we had been drinking. I sniffed at it and said, some of Dan's laudanum, huh? He's still in the hospital?
Yes, I think his skull is fractured.
There's your kick, mister, if that's what you want. I put the dope gin down my throat. Presently, I felt more comfortable. Time went by as we drank and talked in a world that was rosy, cheerful, and full of fellowship and peace on Earth. Dinah stuck to gin. I tried that for a while, too, and then had another gin and laudanum. For a while after that, I played a game, trying to hold my eyes open as if I were awake, even though I couldn't see anything out of them. When the trick wouldn't fool her anymore, I gave it up. The last thing I remembered was her helping me onto the living room Chesterfield. Chapter 21 The 17th Murder. I dreamed I was sitting on a bench in Baltimore, facing the tumbling fountain in Harlem Park, beside a woman who wore a veil. I had come there with her. She was somebody I knew well, but I had suddenly forgotten who she was. I couldn't see her face because of the long black veil. I thought that if I said something to her, I would recognize her voice when she answered. But I was very embarrassed and was a long time finding anything to say. Finally, I asked her if she knew a man named Carol T. Harris. She answered me, but the roar and swish of the tumbling fountain smothered her voice, and I could hear nothing. Fire engines went out Edmondson Avenue. She left me to run after them. As she ran, she cried, "Fire! Fire!" I recognized her voice then and knew who she was, and knew she was someone important to me. I ran after her, but it was too late. She and the fire engines were gone. I walked streets hunting for her, half the streets in the United States. Gay Street and Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore, Colfax Avenue in Denver, Etna Road and St. Clair Avenue in Cleveland, McKinney Avenue in Dallas, Lamartine and Cornell and Amory Streets in Boston, Berry Boulevard in Louisville, Lexington Avenue in New York, until I came to Victoria Street in Jacksonville, where I heard her voice again, though I still couldn't see her. I walked more streets listening to her voice. She was calling a name, not mine, one strange to me. But no matter how fast I walked or in what direction, I could get no nearer her voice. It was the same distance from me in the street that runs past the federal building in El Paso as in Detroit's Grand Circus Park. Then the voice stopped. Tired and discouraged, I went into the lobby of the hotel that faces the railroad station in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, to rest. While I sat there, a train came in. She got off it and came into the lobby, over to me, and began kissing me. I was very uncomfortable because everybody stood around looking at us and laughing. That dream ended there. I dreamed I was in a strange city hunting for a man I hated. I had an open knife in my pocket and meant to kill him with it when I found him. It was Sunday morning. Church bells were ringing. Crowds of people were in the streets, going to and from church. I walked almost as far as in the first dream, but always in this same strange city. Then the man I was after yelled at me, and I saw him. He was a small brown man who wore an immense sombrero. He was standing on the steps of a tall building on the far side of a wide plaza, laughing at me. Between us, the plaza was crowded with people, packed shoulder to shoulder. Keeping one hand on the open knife in my pocket, I ran toward the little brown man, running on the heads and shoulders of the people in the plaza. The heads and shoulders were of unequal heights and not evenly spaced. I slipped and floundered over them. The little brown man stood on the steps and laughed until I had almost reached him. Then he ran into the tall building.
I chased him up miles of spiral stairway, always just an inch more than a hand's reach behind him. We came to the roof. He ran straight across to the edge and jumped just as one of my hands touched him. His shoulder slid out of my fingers. My hand knocked his sombrero off and closed on his head. It was a smooth, hard, round head, no larger than a large egg. My fingers went all the way around it. Squeezing his head in one hand, I tried to bring the knife out of my pocket with the other and realized that I had gone off the edge of the roof with him. We dropped giddily down toward the millions of upturned faces in the plaza. Miles down. I opened my eyes in the dull light of morning sun filtered through drawn blinds. I was lying face down on the dining room floor, my head resting on my left forearm. My right arm was stretched straight out. My right hand held the round blue and white handle of Dinah Brand's ice pick. The pick's 6-inch needle-sharp blade was buried in Dinah Brand's left breast. She was lying on her back, dead. Her long muscular legs were stretched out toward the kitchen door. There was a run down the front of her right stocking. Slowly, gently, as if afraid of waking her, I let go the ice pick, drew in my arm, and got up. My eyes burned. My throat and mouth were hot, woolly. I went into the kitchen, found a bottle of gin, tilted it to my mouth, and kept it there until I had to breathe. The kitchen clock said 7:41. With the gin in me, I returned to the dining room, switched on the lights, and looked at the dead girl. Not much blood was in sight. A spot the size of a silver dollar around the hole the ice pick made in her blue silk dress. There was a bruise on her right cheek, just under the cheekbone. Another bruise, finger-made, was on her right wrist. Her hands were empty. I moved her enough to see that nothing was under her. I examined the room. So far as I could tell, nothing had been changed in it. I went back to the kitchen and found no recognizable changes there. The spring lock on the back door was fastened and had no marks to show it had been monkeyed with. I went to the front door and failed to find any marks on it. I went through the house from top to bottom and learned nothing. The windows were all right. The girl's jewelry on her dressing table, except the 2 diamond rings on her hands, and 400-odd dollars in her handbag, on a bedroom chair, were undisturbed. In the dining room again, I knelt beside the dead girl and used my handkerchief to wipe the ice pick handle clean of any prints my fingers had left on it. I did the same to glasses, bottles, doors, light buttons, and the pieces of furniture I had touched or was likely to have touched. Then I washed my hands, examined my clothes for blood, made sure I was leaving none of my property behind, and went to the front door. I opened it, wiped the inner knob, closed it behind me, wiped the outer knob, and went away. From a drugstore in Upper Broadway, I telephoned Dick Foley and asked him to come over to my hotel. He arrived a few minutes after I got there. Dinah Brand was killed in her house last night or early this morning, I told him, stabbed with an ice pick. The police don't know it yet. I've told you enough about her for you to know that there are any number of people who might have had reason for killing her. There are 3 I want looked up first. Whisper, Dan Rolfe, and Bill Quint, the radical fellow. You've got their descriptions. Rolfe is in the hospital with a dented skull. I don't know which hospital. Try the city first. Get hold of Mickey Linehan. He's still camped on Pete the Finn's trail. And have him let Pete rest while he gives you a hand on this. Find out where those 3 birds were last night, and time means something. The little Canadian op had been watching me curiously while I talked. Now he started to say something, changed his mind, grunted, "Righto," and departed. I went out to look for Reno Starkey. After an hour of searching, I located him by telephone in a Ronnie Street rooming house. "By yourself?" he asked when I had said I wanted to see him. "Yeah." He said I could come out and told me how to get there. I took a taxi. It was a dingy 2-story house near the edge of town.
A couple of men loitered in front of a grocer's on the corner above. Another pair sat on the low wooden steps of the house down at the next corner. None of the four was conspicuously refined in appearance. When I rang the bell, two men opened the door. They weren't so mild-looking either. I was taken upstairs to a front room where Reno, collarless and in shirt sleeves and vest, sat tilted back in a chair with his feet on the windowsill. He nodded his sallow horse face and said, "Pull a chair over." The men who had brought me up went away, closing the door. I sat down and said, "I want an alibi. Dinah Brand was killed last night after I left her. There's no chance of my being copped for it, but with Noonan dead, I don't know how I'm hitched up with the department. I don't want to give them any openings to even try to hang anything on me. If I've got to, I can prove where I was last night, but you can save me a lot of trouble if you will." Reno looked at me with dull eyes and asked, "Why pick on me?" "You phoned me there last night. You're the only person who knows I was there the first part of the night. I'd have to fix it with you, even if I got the alibi somewhere else, wouldn't I?" he asked. "You didn't croak her, did you?" I said, "No," casually. He stared out the window a little while before he spoke. He asked, "What made you think I'd give you the lift? Do I owe you anything for what you done to me at Wilson's last night?" I said, "I didn't hurt you any. The news was half out anyway. Whisper knew enough to guess the rest. I only gave you a showdown. What do you care? You can take care of yourself." "I aim to try," he agreed. "All right. You was at the Tanner house in Tanner. That's a little burg 23 miles up the hill. You went up there after you left Wilson's and stayed till morning. A guy named Ricker that hangs around Murray's with a hire heap drove you up and back. You ought to know what you was doing up there. Give me a cig and I'll have it put on the register." "Thanks," I said as I unscrewed my fountain pen. "Don't say them. I'm doing this because I need all the friends I can get. When the time comes that you sit in with me and Whisper and Pete, I don't expect the sour end of it." "You won't get it," I promised. "Who's going to be chief of police?" "McGraw's acting chief. He'll likely cinch it." "How'll he play?" "With the Finn. Rough stuff will hurt his shop just like it does Pete's. It'll have to be hurt some. I'd be a swell mutt to sit still while a guy like Whisper is on the loose. It's me or him. Think he croaked the broad?" "He had reason enough," I said as I gave him the slip of paper on which I had written my name. "She double-crossed him, sold him out, plenty." "You and her was kind of thick, wasn't you?" he asked. I let the question alone, lighting a cigarette. Reno waited a while and then said, "You better hunt up Ricker and let him get a look at you so he'll know how to describe you if he's asked." A long-legged youngster of 22 or so, with a thin, freckled face around reckless eyes, opened the door and came into the room. Reno introduced him to me as Hank O'Mara. I stood up to shake his hand and then asked Reno, "Can I reach you here if I need to?" "No, Pete Murray?" "I've met him and I know his joint. Anything you give him will get to me," he said. "We're getting out of here. It's not so good. That Tanner lay is all set." "Right, thanks." I went out of the house. Chapter 22. The Ice Pick. Downtown, I went first to police headquarters. McGraw was holding down the chief's desk. His blonde-lashed eyes looked suspiciously at me, and the lines in his leathery face were even deeper and sourer than usual. "When do you see Dinah Brand last?" he asked without any preliminaries, not even a nod. His voice rasped disagreeably through his bony nose. 10:40 last night, or thereabout," I said. "Why?" "Where?" "Her house." "How long you been there?" 10 minutes, maybe 15. "Why?" "Why what?" "Why didn't you stay any longer than that?" "What," I asked, sitting down in the chair he hadn't offered me, "makes it any of your business?" He glared at me while he filled his lungs so he could yell, "Murder!" in my face. I laughed and said, "You don't think she had anything to do with Noonan's killing?" I wanted a cigarette, but cigarettes were too well known as first aids to the nervous for me to take a chance on one just then. McGraw was trying to look through my eyes. I let him look, having all sorts of confidence in my belief that, like a lot of people, I looked most honest when I was lying. Presently he gave up the eye study and asked, "Why not?" That was weak enough. I said, "All right, why not?" indifferently, offered him a cigarette and took one myself. Then I added, "My guess is that Whisper did it. Was he there?" For once McGraw cheated his nose, snapping the words off his teeth. "Was he where?" "At Brand's." "No," I said, wrinkling my forehead. "Why should he be, if he was off killing Noonan?" "Damn Noonan," the acting chief exclaimed irritably. "What do you keep dragging him in for?" I tried to look at him as if I thought him crazy. He said, "Dinah Brand was murdered last night." I said, "Yeah?" "Now will you answer my questions?" "Of course." I was at Wilson's with Noonan and the others. After I left there, around 10:30, I dropped in at her house to tell her I had to go up to Tanner. I had a halfway date with her. I stayed there about 10 minutes, long enough to have a drink. There was nobody else there, unless they were hiding. When was she killed, and how? McGraw told me he had sent a pair of his dicks, Shep and Vanaman, to see the girl that morning, to see how much help she could and would give the department in copping Whisper for Noonan's murder. The dicks got to her house at 9:30. The front door was ajar. Nobody answered their ringing. They went in and found the girl lying on her back in the dining room, dead, with a stab wound in her left breast. The doctor who examined the body said she had been killed with a slender, round, pointed blade about 6 inches in length at about 3 o'clock in the morning. Bureaus, closets, trunks, and so on had apparently been skillfully and thoroughly ransacked. There was no money in the girl's handbag or elsewhere in the house. The jewel case on her dressing table was empty. 2 diamond rings were on her fingers. The police hadn't found the weapon with which she had been stabbed. The fingerprint experts hadn't turned up anything they could use. Neither doors nor windows seemed to have been forced. The kitchen showed that the girl had been drinking with a guest or guests. 6 inches, round, slim, pointed, I repeated the weapon's description. That sounds like her ice pick. McGraw reached for the phone and told somebody to send Shep and Vanaman in. Shep was a stoop-shouldered tall man whose wide mouth had a grimly honest look that probably came from bad teeth. The other detective was short, stocky, with purplish veins in his nose and hardly any neck. McGraw introduced us and asked them about the ice pick. They had not seen it, were positive it hadn't been there. They wouldn't have overlooked an article of its sort.
"Was it there last night?" McGraw asked me.
I stood beside her while she chipped off pieces of ice with it. I described it. McGraw told the dicks to search her house again, and then to try to find the pick in the vicinity of the house.
"You knew her," he said when Shep and Vanaman had gone. "What's your slant on it?"
"Too new for me to have one," I dodged the question. "Give me an hour or two to think it over. What do you think?" He fell back into sourness, growling,
"How the hell do I know?"
But the fact that he let me go away without asking me any more questions told me he had already made up his mind that Whisper had killed the girl. I wondered if the little gambler had done it, or if this was another of the wrong raps that Poisonville police chiefs liked to hang on him. It didn't seem to make much difference now. It was a cinch he had, personally or by deputy, put Noonan out, and they could only hang him once. There were a lot of men in the corridor when I left McGraw. Some of these men were quite young, just kids, Quite a few were foreigners, and most of them were every bit as tough-looking as any men should be. Near the street door, I met Donner, one of the coppers who had been on the Cedar Hill expedition. "Hello," I greeted him. "What's the mob? Emptying the can to make room for more?"
"Them's our new specials," he told me,
speaking as if he didn't think much of them.
"We're gonna have an augmented force."
"Congratulations," I said, and went on out. In his pool room, I found Peak Murray sitting at a desk behind the cigar counter talking to three men. I sat down on the other side of the room and watched two kids knock balls around. In a few minutes, the lanky proprietor came over to me. "If you see Reno sometime," I told him, "you might let him know that Pete the Finn's having his mob sworn in as special coppers."
"I might," Murray agreed.
Mickey Linehan was sitting in the lobby when I got back to my hotel. He followed me up to my room and reported,
"Your Dan Rolfe pulled the sneak from the hospital somewhere after midnight last night. The croakers are kind of steamed up about it. Seems they were figuring on pulling a lot of little pieces of bone out of his brain this morning. But him and his duds were gone. We haven't got a line on Whisper yet. Dick's out now trying to place Bill Quint. What's what on this girl's carving? Dick tells me you got it before the coppers."
The telephone bell rang. A man's voice, carefully oratorical, spoke my name with a question mark after it. I said,
"Yeah."
The voice said,
"This is Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn speaking. I think you will find it well worth your while to appear at my offices at your earliest convenience."
"Will I? Who are you?"
"Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn, attorney at law. My suite is in the Rutledge Block, 310 Green Street. I think you will find it well..."
"Mind telling me part of what it's about?" I asked.
"There are affairs best not discussed over the telephone. I think you will find..."
"All right," I interrupted him again. "I'll be around to see you this afternoon if I get a chance."
"You will find it very, very advisable," he assured me.
I hung up on that. Mickey said,
"You were gonna give me the what's what on the brand slaughter."
I said, "I wasn't. I started to say it oughtn't be hard to trace Rolfe, running around with a fractured skull and probably a lot of bandages. Suppose you try it. Give Hurricane Street a play first." Mickey grinned all the way across his comedian's red face, said,
"Don't tell me anything that's going on. I'm only working with you."
Picked up his hat and left me. I spread myself on the bed, smoked cigarettes end to end, and thought about last night, my frame of mind, my passing out, my dreams, and the situation into which I woke. The thinking was unpleasant enough to make me glad when it was interrupted. Fingernails scratched the outside of my door. I opened the door. The man who stood there was a stranger to me. He was young, thin, and gaudily dressed. He had heavy eyebrows and a small mustache that were coal black against a very pale, nervous, but not timid face.
"I'm Ted Wright," he said, holding out a hand as if I were glad to meet him. "I guess you've heard Whisper talk about me."
I gave him my hand, let him in, closed the door, and asked, "You're a friend of Whisper's?"
"You bet."
He held up two thin fingers pressed tightly together.
"Just like that, me and him."
I didn't say anything. He looked around the room, smiled nervously, crossed to the open bathroom door, peeped in, came back to me, rubbed his lips with his tongue, and made his proposition.
"I'll knock him off for you for a half a grand."
"Whisper?"
"Yep, and it's dirt cheap."
"Why do I want him killed?" I asked.
"He unwomaned you, didn't he?"
"Yeah."
"You ain't that dumb."
A notion stirred in my noodle. To give it time to crawl around, I said, "Sit down. This needs talking over."
"It don't need nothing,"
he said, looking at me sharply, not moving toward either chair.
"You either want him knocked off or you don't."
"Then I don't." He said something I didn't catch, down in his throat, and
turned to the door. I got between him and it. He stopped, his eyes fidgeting. I said, "So Whisper's dead?" He stepped back and put a hand behind him. I poked his jaw, leaning my 190 pounds on the poke. He got his legs crossed and went down. I pulled him up by the wrists, yanked his face close to mine, and growled, "Come through. What's the racket?"
"I ain't done nothing to you."
"Let me catch you. Who got Whisper?"
"I don't know nothing,
I let go of one of his wrists, slapped his face with my open hand, caught his wrist again, and tried my luck at crunching both of them while I repeated, "Who got Whisper?"
"Dan Rolfe,"
he whined.
"He walked up to him and stuck him with the same skewer Whisper had used on the twist."
"That's right."
"How do you know it was the one Whisper killed the girl with?"
"Dan said so."
"What did Whisper say?"
"Nothing. He looked funny as hell standing there with the butt of the sticker sticking out his side. Then he flashes the rod and puts two pills in Dan just like one, and the both of them go down together cracking heads. Dan's all bloody through the bandages."
"And then what?"
"Then nothing. I rolled them over and they're a pair of stiffs. Every word I'm telling you is gospel."
"Who else was there?"
"Nobody else. Whisper was hiding out with only me to go between him and the mob. He killed Noonan himself, and he didn't want to have to trust nobody for a couple of days till he could see what was what, excepting me."
"So you, being a smart boy, thought you could run around to his enemies and pick up a little dough for killing him after he was dead?"
"I was clean, and this won't be no place for Whisper's pals when the word gets out that he's croaked,"
Wright whined.
"I had to raise a getaway stake."
"How'd you make out so far?"
"I got a century from Pete and a century and a half from Peak Murray for Reno, with more promised from both when I turned the trick."
The whine changed into boasting as he talked.
"I bet you I could get McGraw to come across too, and I thought you'd kick in with something."
"They must be high in the air to toss dough at a woozy racket like that."
"I don't know," he said superiorly. "It ain't such a lousy one at that."
He became humble again.
"Give me a chance, Chief. Don't gum it on me. I'll give you $50 now and a split of whatever I get from McGraw if you'll keep your clam shut till I can put it over and grab a rattler."
"Nobody but you knows where Whisper is?"
"Nobody else except Dan. That's as dead as he is."
"Where are they?"
"The old Redmond warehouse down on Porter Street, in the back upstairs. Whisper had a room fixed up with a bed, stove, and some grub. Give me a chance. $50 now and a cut on the rest."
I let go of his arm and said, "I don't want the dough, but go ahead. I'll lay off for a couple of hours. That ought to be long enough."
"Thanks, Chief. Thanks, thanks."
And he hurried away from me. I put on my coat and hat, went out, found Green Street and the Rutledge block. It was a wooden building, a long while past any prime it might ever have had. Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn's establishment was on the second floor. There was no elevator. I climbed a worn and rickety flight of wooden steps. The lawyer had two rooms, both dingy, smelly, and poorly lighted. I waited in the outer one while a clerk who went well with the rooms carried my name in to the lawyer. Half a minute later, the clerk opened the door and beckoned me in. Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn was a little fat man of 50-something. He had prying, triangular eyes of a very light color, a short, fleshy nose, and a fleshier mouth whose greediness was only partly hidden between a ragged gray mustache and a ragged gray Van Dyke beard. His clothes were dark and unclean-looking without actually being dirty. He didn't get up from his desk, and throughout my visit, he kept his right hand on the edge of a desk drawer that was some 6 inches open. He said,
"Ah, my dear sir, I am extremely gratified to find that you had the good judgment to recognize the value of my counsel."
His voice was even more oratorical than it had been over the wire. I didn't say anything. Nodding his whiskers as if my not saying anything was another exhibition of good judgment, he continued,
I may say, in all justice, that you will find it the invariable part of sound judgment to follow the dictates of my counsel in all cases. I may say this, my dear sir, without false modesty, appreciating with both fitting humility and a deep sense of true and lasting values my responsibilities as well as my prerogatives as a, and why should I stoop to conceal the fact that there are those who feel justified in preferring to substitute the definite article for the indefinite, recognized and accepted leader of the bar in this thriving state.
He knew a lot of sentences like those, and he didn't mind using them on me. Finally, he got along to,
"Thus, that conduct which in a minor practitioner might seem irregular becomes, when he who exercises it occupies such indisputable prominence in his community, and, I might say, not merely the immediate community, as serves to place him above fear of reproach, simply that greater ethic which scorns the pettier conventionalities when confronted with an opportunity to serve mankind through one of its individual representatives. Therefore, my dear sir, I have not hesitated to brush aside scornfully all trivial considerations of accepted precedent to summon you, to say to you frankly and candidly, my dear sir, that your interests will best be served by and through retaining me as your legal representative."
I asked, "What'll it cost?"
"That," he said loftily, "is of but secondary importance. However, it is a detail which has its deserved place in our relationship and must not be overlooked or neglected. We shall say $1,000 now. Later, no doubt..."
He ruffled his whiskers and didn't finish the sentence. I said I hadn't, of course, that much money on me.
"Naturally, my dear sir, naturally. But that is of not the least importance in any degree, none whatever. Any time will do for that, any time up to 10 o'clock tomorrow morning."
"At 10 tomorrow," I agreed. "Now I'd like to know why I'm supposed to need legal representatives." He made an indignant face.
"My dear sir, this is no matter for jesting, of that I assure you."
I explained that I hadn't been joking, that I really was puzzled. He cleared his throat, frowned more or less importantly, said,
"It may well be, my dear sir, that you do not fully comprehend the peril that surrounds you, but it is indubitably preposterous that you should expect me to suppose that you are without any inkling of the difficulties, the legal difficulties, my dear sir, with which you are about to be confronted, growing, as they do, out of occurrences that took place at no more remote time than last night, my dear sir, last night. However, there is no time to go into that now. I have a pressing appointment with Judge Leffner. On the morrow I shall be glad to go more thoroughly into each least ramification of the situation, and I assure you they are many with you. I shall expect you at 10 tomorrow morning."
I promised to be there and went out. I spent the evening in my room, drinking unpleasant whiskey, thinking unpleasant thoughts, and waiting for reports that didn't come from Mickey and Dick. I went to sleep at midnight.
Chapter 23. Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn. I was half-dressed the next morning when Dick Foley came in. He reported, in his word-saving manner, that Bill Quint had checked out of the Miners' Hotel at noon the previous day, leaving no forwarding address. A train left Personville for Ogden at 12:35. Dick had wired the Continental's Salt Lake branch to send a man up to Ogden to try to trace Quint. "We can't pass up any leads," I said, "but I don't think Quint's the man we want." She gave him the air long ago. If he had meant to do anything about it, he would have done it before this. My guess is that when he heard she had been killed, he decided to duck, being a discarded lover who had threatened her. Dick nodded and said,
"Gunplay out the road last night. Hijacking, 4 trucks of hooch, nailed, burned."
That sounded like Reno Starkey's answer to the news that the big bootlegger's mob had been sworn in as special coppers. Mickey Linehan arrived by the time I had finished dressing.
Dan Rolfe was at the house all right, he reported. The Greek grocer on the corner saw him come out around 9 yesterday morning. He went down the street wobbling and talking to himself. The Greek thought he was drunk. How come the Greek didn't tell the police, or did he? Wasn't asked. A swell department this Berg's got. What do we do? Find him for them and turn him in with the job all tacked up?
McGraw has decided Whisper killed her, I said, and he's not bothering himself with any leads that don't lead that way. Unless he came back later for the ice pick, Rolfe didn't turn the trick. She was killed at 3 in the morning. Rolfe wasn't there at 8:30, and the pick was still sticking in her. It was... Dick Foley came over to stand in front of me and ask,
"How do you know?"
I didn't like the way he looked or the way he spoke. I said, "You know, because I'm telling you." Dick didn't say anything. Mickey grinned his half-wit's grin and asked,
"Where do we go from here? Let's get this thing polished off."
"I've got a date for 10, I told them. "Hang around the hotel till I get back. Whisper and Rolfe are probably dead, so we won't have to hunt for them." I scowled at Dick and said, "I was told that. I didn't kill either of them." The little Canadian nodded without lowering his eyes from mine. I ate breakfast alone and then set out for the lawyer's office. Turning off King Street, I saw Hank O'Mara's freckled face in an automobile that was going up Green Street. He was sitting beside a man I didn't know. The long-legged youngster waved an arm at me and stopped the car. I went over to him. He said,
"Reno wants to see you."
"Where will I find him?"
"Jump in."
"I can't go now," I said. "Probably not till afternoon."
"See Peak when you're ready."
I said I would. O'Mara and his companion drove on up Green Street. I walked half a block south to the Rutledge block. With a foot on the first of the rickety steps that led up to the lawyer's floor, I stopped to look at something. It was barely visible back in a dim corner of the first floor. It was a shoe. It was lying in a position that empty shoes don't lie in. I took my foot off the step and went toward the shoe. Now I could see an ankle and the cuff of a black pants leg above the shoe top. That prepared me for what I found. I found Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn huddled among two brooms, a mop, and a bucket, in a little alcove formed by the back of the stairs and a corner of the wall. His Van Dyke beard was red with blood from a cut that ran diagonally across his forehead. His head was twisted sideways and backward at an angle that could only be managed with a broken neck. I quoted Noonan's "What's got to be done has got to be done" to myself, and, gingerly, pulling one side of the dead man's coat out of the way, emptied his inside coat pocket, transferring a black book and a sheaf of papers to my own pocket. In two of his other pockets, I found nothing I wanted. The rest of his pockets couldn't be got at without moving him, and I didn't care to do that. 5 minutes later, I was back in the hotel, going in through a side door to avoid Dick and Mickey in the lobby, and walking up to the mezzanine to take an elevator. In my room, I sat down and examined my loot. I took the book first, a small imitation leather memoranda book of the sort that sells for not much money in any stationery store. It held some fragmentary notes that meant nothing to me, and 30-some names and addresses that meant as little, with one exception. Helen Albury, 1229A Hurricane Street. That was interesting because, first, a young man named Robert Albury was in prison, having confessed that he shot and killed Donald Wilson in a fit of jealousy aroused by Wilson's supposed success with Dinah Brand. And, second, Dinah Brand had lived and had been murdered at 1232 Hurricane Street, across the street from 1229A. I did not find my name in the book. I put the book aside and began unfolding and reading the papers I had taken with it. Here, too, I had to wade through a lot that didn't mean anything to find something that did. This find was a group of four letters held together by a rubber band. The letters were in slitted envelopes that had postmarks dated a week apart on the average. The latest was a little more than 6 months old. The letters were addressed to Dinah Brand. The first, that is, the earliest, wasn't so bad for a love letter. The second was a bit goofier. The third and fourth were swell examples of how silly an ardent and unsuccessful wooer can be, especially if he's getting on in years. The four letters were signed by Elihu Wilson. I had not found anything to tell me definitely why Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn had thought he could blackmail me out of $1,000, but I had found plenty to think about. I encouraged my brain with two Fatimas and then went downstairs. "Go out and see what you can raise on a lawyer named Charles Proctor Dawn," I told Mickey. "He's got offices in Green Street. Stay away from them. Don't put in a lot of time on him. I just want a rough line quick." I told Dick to give me a 5-minute start and then follow me out to the neighborhood of 1229A Hurricane Street. 1229A was the upper flat in a 2-story building almost directly opposite Dinah's house. 1229 was divided into two flats with a private entrance for each. I rang the bell at the one I wanted. The door was opened by a thin girl of 18 or 19 with dark eyes set close together in a shiny yellowish face under short-cut brown hair that looked damp. She opened the door, made a choked, frightened sound in her throat, and backed away from me, holding both hands to her mouth. "Miss Helen Albury?" I asked. She shook her head violently from side to side. There was no truthfulness in it. Her eyes were crazy. I said, "I'd like to come in and talk to you a few minutes," going in as I spoke, closing the door behind me. She didn't say anything. She went up the steps in front of me, her head twisted around so she could watch me with her scary eyes. We went into a scantily furnished living room. Dinah's house could be seen from its windows. The girl stood in the center of the room, her hands still to her mouth. I wasted time and words trying to convince her that I was harmless. It was no good. Everything I said seemed to increase her panic. It was a damned nuisance. I quit trying and got down to business. "You are Robert Albury's sister?" I asked. No reply, nothing but the senseless look of utter fear. I said, "After he was arrested for killing Donald Wilson, you took this flat so you could watch her. What for?" Not a word from her. I had to supply my own answer. "Revenge. You blamed Dinah Brand for your brother's trouble. You watched for your chance. It came the night before last. You sneaked into her house, found her drunk, stabbed her with the ice pick you found there." She didn't say anything. I hadn't succeeded in jolting the blankness out of her frightened face. I said, "Dawn helped you, engineered it for you. He wanted Elihu Wilson's letters. Who was the man he sent to get them? The man who did the actual killing? Who was he?" That got me nothing. No change in her expression or lack of expression. No word. I thought I would like to spank her. I said, "I've given you your chance to talk. I'm willing to listen to your side of the story, but suit yourself." She suited herself by keeping quiet. I gave it up. I was afraid of her, afraid she would do something even crazier than her silence if I pressed her further. I went out of the flat, not sure that she had understood a single word I had said. At the corner, I told Dick Foley, "There's a girl in there, Helen Albury, 18. 5'6", skinny, not more than 100, if that, eyes close together, brown, yellow skin, brown short hair, straight, got on a gray suit now. Tail her. If she cuts up on you, throw her in the can. Be careful, she's crazy as a bedbug." I set out for Peak Murray's dump to locate Reno and see what he wanted. Half a block from my destination, I stepped into an office building doorway to look the situation over. A police patrol wagon stood in front of Murray's. Men were being led, dragged, carried from pool room to wagon. The leaders, draggers, and carriers didn't look like regular coppers. They were, I supposed, Pete the Finn's crew, now special officers. Pete, with McGraw's help, apparently was making good his threat to give Whisper and Reno all the war they wanted. While I watched, an ambulance arrived, was loaded, and drove away. I was too far away to recognize anybody or any bodies. When the height of the excitement seemed past, I circled a couple of blocks and returned to my hotel. Mickey Linehan was there with information about Mr. Charles Proctor Dawn.
"He's the guy that the joke was wrote about. Is he a criminal lawyer?"